Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week took us to a place we don't usually go on this podcast. Yes, Chris is a veteran, and yes, he's involved in agriculture. But his mission today focuses on using agriculture as a way to heal men in crisis. Chris Wilson is the logistics manager for Rockside Ranch, a working ranch in a rural community aimed at helping young men overcome crisis and live the life they were created to live. Chris served more than 20 years with the U.S. Army National Guard, where he led and supervised thousands of troops over his career, including multiple deployments to combat theaters. Upon his retirement, Chris and his family moved to Scott Valley after hearing a call to ministry. Chris uses his background and training every day at Rockside to develop leadership, organization, and teamwork. In addition, Chris is actively pursuing a theological seminary degree. In this episode, Chris and I get into his military career, spanning 4 deployments, tours to Iraq and Afghanistan, and a near-death experience. We also talk about how the hand of God was at work in his life, setting the conditions for his retirement and movement back to California and into his mission at Rockside. We talk about what exactly they're doing at Rockside and how they're talking life into a group of rough men, using agriculture as their canvas, if you will. And finally, we get into this idea of stewardship and the principles around it and the values that it can impart on young men who have often taken that for granted most of their life. Enjoy.
My father was in the Air Force. So he got out right after the Vietnam conflict. And of all places, just outside Phoenix, Luke Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. So I was born in Phoenix. Grew up in Arizona for about the first 9 years. We moved to Bakersfield. When I was about 10, and then kind of migrated all through California. My father worked for, started off with Nestle, got transferred to the Bakersfield plant. And then after a little bit of downsizing, he started working for Ecolabs.
So you spent the majority of your 9 years old and forward time in the California area?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. Did you guys have any agricultural experience at that time in Bakersfield growing up?
Absolutely not. Okay. Lived in the suburbs. Okay. Yeah. So then of course from Bakersfield. So right as I was about to start high school, like I said, my father got hired for Ecolabs. Mm-hmm. And we moved up to just outside Modesto. So about 200-300 miles up north. Okay. And so a more rural, in my opinion, at that point in my life, a rural community called Oakdale. So I ended up going to high school in Oakdale. Graduated, I'm going to date myself here, graduated in 97.
Fair enough.
Yeah. But I actually, so the I was in the junior ROTC program. Mm-hmm. At one of the sister schools in Riverbank. And that kind of sparked a little bit of interest in joining the military. Granted, it was Navy or JROTC. We took a trip, the summer year between junior and senior year to Washington, D.C. with the group. And one of the National Guard recruiters volunteered as a chaperone. Well played, recruiter.
That's right.
He invited a bunch of us to do a ride along with the unit in Oakdale.
Okay.
And it was an anti-armor infantry company. And I was one of the ones that actually did the ride along and realized that Army life at that point, as for a 17-year-old, probably wasn't that bad with all my life experience.
That's right.
Right there, I think, what was it? August, right before I started my senior year, I had to get my parents to sign my permission slip to join the National Guard. And newly minted Private Wilson was trying to finish high school, play sports, and somehow make the weekend drills.
Yeah.
And then get ready for basic training.
Growing up, Chris, in that area of California, in kind of a suburban area, your father had been in the military. He transitions out now. Given the kind of work that you do today, you know, with a young man at Rockside Ranch, are there or is there a particular instance that you can recall from that early childhood growing up where you experienced something or there you learned a lesson maybe the hard way that shaped how you looked at life coming into the military as a 17-year-old kid?
I love my father to death. He passed away about 10 years ago. My parents' marriage wasn't that strong at that point. And they actually divorced about 2 months after I joined the National Guard. And that really, really honed on as far as like stepping up. It felt like I had to step up for my mother and my brother into that leadership role, and also just the whole principle of commitment, especially with family, that of course can be that can cross over into other aspects, to include the military, to include in just about any walk in life. So
this sort of need to essentially be the father, the man figure, and the father figure in your life, was kind of thrust upon your shoulders at that stage as you come into the service. So was the service for you sort of this idea of being able to provide?
It wasn't. It actually, both my grandfathers served during World War II. My father served in Vietnam, like I said, and it's just really seemed like that calling. It was something I was always interested in. Granted, all my paths didn't line up like I thought they would. I've always just had this strong urge to just serve, whether it be in the military, whether it be in community, whether it be in whatever church. So it's just like one of those God-given gifts. That as Forrest Gump said, it's like a duck in water.
You come into the National Guard, you're 17 years old, you're kind of alone and unafraid for the first time. What do those first few years look like?
So start off behind probably my favorite job in the Army, 50 cal / tail gunner.
It's about to be.
Yeah, living the dream. Fast forward about, so this is all March of 2000.
This is still pre 9/11 then.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Rocking the BDUs.
Where were you when that happened?
So September 11th, I was at Fort Campbell. I'd actually, the month prior, I just graduated PLDC,
which is
Primary Leadership Development Course for promotion to sergeant.
Okay.
So September 11th happened. I was in my buddy's room where we just got done with PT. And of course, like I said, the BDU days, so starching my uniform, shining my boots, mm-hmm. and changing into the duty uniform. And one of our gunners knocks on the door, is like, hey, yeah, like a plane hit a building in New York. And we're like, that's kind of weird. 20 minutes later, he pops back in. He's like, yeah, a second plane hit. And that's when like everything just went super crazy. I love our S2 guys or Intel guys. But there was some reports that were just like crazy coming out. Like a car bomb blew up the Washington Monument. This is going on. We're all under attack. Like lock everything down. And next thing I know, we're literally doing armed dismounted patrols around Fort Campbell. Jeez. So yeah, it was by what time was that? It was like nine.
Yeah, it was early.
9 in the morning.
Yeah.
By the time we, by about, 1300, we're already mounted up and doing patrols. Jeez. So yeah.
But you mean you found it? I think you found enough value in that, in those experiences to make it a career. I think I had seen mm-hmm. that you were in for, 20, 22, 23 years.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of talk us through some of those major events through that storied career.
Yeah. So, a bunch of surreal moments, on that.
Describe one.
We actually protected Jessica Lynch's convoy the night
prior. Did you really?
Yeah, the night prior to them going into that town.
No kidding.
My platoon leader went up to their company commander and said, "Hey, we're leaving at 4. If you want to escort around the city," he's like, "No, we're gonna sleep in." Okay.
Jeez.
Yeah. So.
So I mean, you come back what late 2003.
Yeah, that was a year deployment at that point.
Good, now your wife did love you.
Yes, she did. So, and it was always funny because everyone from the division commander on down would like come and when they come and visit us, they're like, "Hey, we got it. We know you guys had a quick turnaround. We're gonna get you as home as soon as possible." 6 months, 7 months. Right, that time frame.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that 6 month mark hits, and then come back. All right, 8-9 months. Okay, we'll get you back home. All right, that 9 month mark hits. All right, 1 year, we're gonna get you home. All right, cool.
and it sitting here today, 3 months. Yeah, no big deal. But
yeah,
man, I mean, when you hit that 6 month mark and you think that's it, and then you tack on another three, that's devastating. And you tack on another three on that. That feeling is hard to describe.
Yeah. You know? So we did that. So from Harp Shell, our battalion actually got attached to Third ID when they did the Thunder Runs into Baghdad.
Oh wow!
And so if you ever watched the video with the guys with the weird burlap on their mm-hmm. Kevlars, mm-hmm. that was mm-hmm. us. So they would push through, and of course we'd come back behind them and clear all the buildings and secure behind all the tanks. So watching tank battles through the TOW ITAS commander's viewer was that was another really surreal moment.
What was the decision, Chris? I mean, at the end of this career, to decide it's time to hang it up.
Actually, injuries. So so my third deployment was into Ramadi at the time, 2005, 2006. Yeah. And the best way I can describe Ramadi was a 365-day firefight.
Yeah. At that point.
Thinking I knew combat. Hey, I did both invasions. I got shot at a couple times. I'm like, yeah, well, we got this. Nope, not even close. We could set our watch within 45 minutes. We're in contact with the enemy. So all the stories about Ramadi are true. I mean, I could tell you some, but I always wonder if I'm like telling these stories, if people actually believe me or not, but
go ahead, try me.
Yeah. So, shoot. So surreal moment. We're pushing hard into about the center of the city. So the city is divided by a north-south road. So the army sector, we're on the east side. So Easy Street was the divider. So anything but easy. and the Marine Corps had the west side. Mm-hmm. The train station was right at the end of Easy Street, and my platoon had actually set up a support by fire about 2 kilometers away that we could watch with the ITAS and binoculars. And we end up finding out that they had a weapons cache at the train station. So it almost became a game. Like, we'd see them loading up. We start working with our FOs or forward observers to call artillery on them. Mm-hmm. And seeing who was fastest that day. But finally we started pushing in a little bit deeper into the city, and my platoon actually went up to the train station, and I'm looking out the window, and I just had the angle right on the Humvee where you see the curtains open on the second story window, the muzzle of the AK come out, smash the window, and just start shooting at us. And literally all of us were like so shocked. It's like, that happened? It's like one of those like, wow, man, that's like the movies. So, I mean, it's like constant stuff like that. Or another one. Yeah, I'm sitting on just on the edge of Easy Street, and I'm talking with my driver. At this point, yeah, I'm still a sectional leader. So I'm talking to my driver, and I'm like, hey man, look, I want you to look left for any possible IEDs. If we have to go down the road, I'm gonna look right. My gunner thought I was talking to him. So my gunner's looking left, not straight ahead like he should be. My driver's looking left, I'm looking right, and literally all of a sudden it's like I drop my binos. I look to our 12 o'clock. There's like five insurgents carrying RPGs and everything. And both of our eyes are like just shocked at each other. Like, whoa, whoa.
Just right in front of the Humvee?
Yeah, right across the street. So we took, what was it? Seven RPGs, all missed.
Oh my gosh.
and then an insurgent machine gun team snuck around on our left flank and started peppering us, and one round hit my truck. One single round. And like this is kind of the mindset at this point for us. We started cheering when they hit our truck, like, hey, you got us.
Did you guys get him?
Kind of. We actually took out most of the RPG team.
the injuries that were the ultimate cause of your separation were from that deployment.
Yeah. So it was we were pushing in. It was actually a really rough day. I'll leave it at, I became a platoon sergeant the hard way. Mm-hmm. So we got called back out. It was April 9th, 2006. And just seemed like the city exploded that day. It started about 2 in the morning when we took a catastrophic ID to one of our trucks. And the heavy QRF came out, so two M1 tanks. They took a catastrophic IED to one of their tanks. Thankfully, the entire crew got out. We ended up going back in to kind of like do a quick refit, not thinking we're going to get called back out. But within, it was about It was about 11 o'clock in the morning, so 9 hours later, we're back out in the fight again, and all day, like, just stuff exploding, firefights everywhere, and of all things, I'm using my engine block as cover on my truck. I'm dismounted on the passenger side, and the importance of communication. They never told us that our platoon was doing a relief in place. So I was out there, and as one of our sister platoons comes roaring up, I get crushed between my gun truck and their gun truck as they're backing up, and literally a few. What do they say when you think you're gonna die, your life flashes before your eyes? I was very upset. I was literally like, if everything I've been through in the city and this is how I'm going to die, I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. thankfully my body armor actually caught the bottom of the antenna on their truck and spun me. So most of the impact was just on my right hip. And of course I did at that point got evac'd over to Camp Ramadi, and got shot up with morphine. Morphine doesn't kill the pain, just makes you not care. and my sergeant major scratched my face for me. Yeah, that's how much I didn't care. Yeah, so about a week later, I faked the funk enough to get back into the fight, and I did what every infantryman does, and what I caution guys now. There's that thin line between hard and stupid, and I crossed it, and hoping that magically my hip would heal, and it never did. And of all things, fast forward to about 5 years ago, so almost. Yeah, a little over 10 years after the injury, I'm of all places again, Fort Jackson as a basic training first sergeant. stepped in a hole in the last mile of a 12-mile foot march and felt all of my hip just shear. Oh. So yeah, two hip surgeries later, realizing I can't run anymore, and yeah. At that point, it's like an infantryman that can't run is, I mean, yeah. I'm just stealing oxygen at that point. So,
yeah.
So, yeah. So that's kind of what led to the decision to retire. This is where it kind of gets weird. talk about the hand of God, destiny, whatever you want to do. Of course, like you and I discussed before, so I am Christian. So I'll use the hand of God part maneuvering stuff in my life. So was going to church as a teenager. Got saved, but wasn't really living the life, because about the same time as when I joined the National Guard. So of course, infantry locker room mentality.
Yeah.
So always was kind of in between two worlds at that point. I got a lot of spiritual growth from this church in South Carolina. So truly believe that that's where, like I said, yeah, hand of God, where God was directing us to go, or destiny, or whatever you want to call it, kind of fed into that. So I'm literally dead set. Like, you cannot get me to step foot back into the state of California. There's a reason I joined the Army, because I wanted to leave the state of California. Mm-hmm. So the pastor of our church, now granted, we're to give you an idea of where we're living at right now, so the population of the entire valley is about 1400 people.
Okay.
So everyone knows everyone's business. Everyone like knew we were moving here before I even knew I was probably moving here. Like I said, this work kind of gets weird. So we're doing a small group at our pastor's house, and my wife was out here visiting her family. So her family all moved up here the last 20 years. So we're in the small town of Etna. At the pastor's house, my wife's out here visiting family. And so I walk in solo, and he's like, like, your wife coming? I'm like, no, she's in California visiting family. She's just kind of sitting there. He's like, okay. You ever heard of called Aetna? Like, you're in Columbia, South Carolina. How do you know? I'm like, are you following her on Facebook? It's like, no, I've been there. Why? So there's a lot of church community, a lot of like church camps that we found out that were out here. And after doing a lot of praying and a lot of other stuff, literally it just like all the doors started closing because I really wanted to go back up to Alaska, live out my life up there hunting and fishing. At this point, yeah, I just had two hip surgeries, and so it's I already see the writing on the wall. It's like I need to just write my time and get out.
Okay.
And so we finally, it's like, yeah, again, a little begrudgingly, dragging my feet. It's like, fine, I guess we're going to California. So you
moved up there because your wife had already been up there, or because the pastor asked you to come up there and
well,
do some work?
No. So yeah. So it was all family. Like I had no idea what I was going to be doing up here.
Okay.
Parting words of encouragement from my brigade chaplain. So he and I became real good friends, and he's like, he looked at me on my last day, saying all my goodbyes, walking to his office, and telling him, yeah, where I'm going and everything. And he's like, all right. Like, yeah. You want everyone come out, fish. I'll find all the spots. And he's like, I don't know, man. I just got this feeling that you're going to talk life into a group of rough men. No, I'm retired. No. Why would I want to do that? So fast forward, 2 months, we finally get out here to California, and literally not knowing anything about anything up here. They're like super, super rural, like farms on every corner. Mm-hmm. It's like, dude, I have no idea what I'm going to be doing here. Start tying into the church, and we're actually living in my in-laws' garage, so that's how unprepared we were moving out here. Of course the housing market isn't a lot either, so we're just hoping for everything to start working out. And out of the blue, my in-laws' neighbors come over one day, we meet them. And my mother-in-law, of course, tells that story about the brigade chaplain and all that. And he happens to be one of the board members for Rockside. About 2 weeks later, our director, Craig Thompson, calls my mother-in-law's house and is like, hey, if you're interested, you want to come out here and check this out? Like, yeah.
Wow.
So, it's kind of cool how everything like starts falling into place at that point. And they hired me on, and the rest is kind of history. So learn the farm life and everything else. So.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. So, I mean, coming from an ag background, I mean, you get sort of this divine message, if you will, from your chaplain who says you're going to talk life into some rough men.
Yep.
Did you start to see that take shape as Craig shows you around Rockside? I mean, maybe give the listeners a sense of what Rockside is.
Okay.
What your mission is, who you guys are serving, and why.
Okay. So Rockside. So we're, I always get this wrong, 501c3? Yes. Sure. 501c3 yeah. Nonprofit. So we're a Christian based organization. It is a working ranch. So we do have, what was the last count? Like 1,500 laying hens. So we collect eggs, clean them, package them, send them to retailers. We do have meat birds. I think right now we've got about 300 meat birds. So we'll do our own butchering and all that. We're trying our hand at sheep and goats. So we'll see what happens. It is a working ranch. Really, the whole premise of it is a life restoration program for young men that have had issues, either just getting their life started or issues with the law, issues with addiction, issues with pretty much whatever you name it. And yeah, so they come in, it's they volunteer for an 8-month program, and through the 8 months they learn everything from, of course, farming, animal husbandry, just taking care of the land, good stewardship, egg processing, like I said, butchering if they fall into that time frame, and of course other life restoration classes through workforce preparedness, through which of course I get to teach. I stole all that stuff from my transition piece, so I could teach them how to do resumes and everything else. workforce readiness, just different classes on just how to be successful in life. And so far, granted, I've only been here for about 2.5 years. So far, I mean, it's like a 93% success rate with all our graduates.
Meaning 93% of the folks that graduate from your program end up with gainful, meaningful employment.
Yes. And, wow. And are very successful at it. And, getting off whatever addictions that they may have. Just kind of going from there. So we've actually have, two ranches right now, throughout the country, and we're trying to get a third one in South Dakota. So we've got Rockside Great Lakes in Michigan, Rockside Etna here, and Rockside Black Hills, which is the one in works. So the one here in Etna, we are more tailored towards men and the age groups of 18 to 26. And the one in Michigan is like the older crowd. So anyone over 26 to, I believe, 40, 45 years old, just want to like kind of restart their life, get stuff together, and survive. Thrive is a better term.
I'm hearing elements of rehab in some ways, describing through this. I mean, my brother struggled with drugs and alcohol when he was, I guess, probably early teenager or so, up through his early 20s. And he had several stints in rehab that, you know, had varying levels of success. He's clean and sober now, but I'm trying to think about how a program like this is different, how it taps into different deficiencies or kind of senses or emotions within a man in crisis that a traditional rehab facility doesn't.
So I've never worked at a traditional rehab facility. So all the information I've gotten are from the previous students that have. So with the guys, it's I'm trying to equate it to now, I don't want to equate it to basic training, but there's elements of it. So we are more graceful than drill sergeants. So we meet every student kind of where they're at. So a lot more grace, a lot more, hey man, this is kind of why we do things. This is why, instead of us yelling at you, this is why we're having a conversation. It's great. I haven't really yelled in 2.5 years. So so I'm kind of calm too. but from So they're locked in. They always have a staff member with them. They actually have volunteered to surrender all their electronic equipment.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. How do you guys control that?
Okay. So we just take their phones, lock it up, and then when they graduate, we give back to them.
8 months.
Yeah, for 8 months. Now we do have student phones for them to use. Or kind of the I don't know what they call them now, dumb phones.
Yeah, little flip phones or something like that, right?
Yeah. So they can't access a lot, but they do have times where they can get on the computer, they can message their family and Facebook and stuff like that. So it's like this total immersion into just getting clean from all the outside influences. So what they see Monday through Friday, of course, is the ranch, what we're doing for the ranch, chores, projects, with the projects being whether we're feeding animals, building pig fences, moving the pig fences, shepherding the animals into different pastures, moving the chickens, so we're rotating the land that they're on. I can go on and on. So that's like what they're getting Monday through Friday. And then, like I said, on top of that, like Wednesdays, I teach my class on workforce readiness. Thursdays and Fridays are other classes between nutrition. Sometimes they'll read a book. Try to blank again. What's the one Jordan Peterson wrote? The 12.
Yeah, 12 steps of something life. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So they'll go through those books or books similar to that, and it's a lot of discussion. And
is Christianity at the center of those discussions?
At times, yeah. Okay. So we don't force Christianity on any of the students. Got it. Yeah. Hey, every morning, we start off with a small devotional, read a verse, kind of compute it to what we're going to do that day and go about our day. And then, for an hour, we'll just do a Bible study. And if the guys don't want to opt in, then that's fine. It's usually they all opt in. Yeah. So it's all just about learning something new. So
how big is each class? How many students per program?
So we can house up to 8.
Okay.
So we're on a continuing cycle is the best way I can put it. So we get guys. As a matter of fact, we had a graduation last weekend of two of the guys. Okay. So right now we're down to 5 guys in the house. So it's like a constant
it's
flow.
Not so, all 8 make 8 months. And then, so no. You get 2 that graduated that started. And so there's a cycle.
Yeah.
And how are you selecting folks to be a part of the program?
So it's, like I said, it's all volunteer basis. So the best way to kind of navigate the whole process is if you go on rocksideranch.org. Mm-hmm. Through the click downs, it will have the application process and everything like that. And kind of from there, we can have a phone interview with the candidates and determine if it is a right fit for them or not. And it's like solely, like, I mean, I think we've helped as many people find other programs that might help them simultaneously finding people that we think that we might be able to help them. So, and of course, like I said, with Michigan opening up, with hopefully South Dakota opening up by the end of this year, just going to kind of expand the whole number of students that we can have throughout the programs. And
the farms are privately held?
They are, yes.
Okay. Can you give an example, Chris, of maybe, you know, a student that's top of mind for you that you can kind of describe their transformation through this process, what they were like when they came in, mm-hmm. and then how they grew and matured through the experiences at Rockside?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll give the example. So one of my guys had just graduated this weekend. So he was from South Dakota, and kind of got tied in with, the program director that's out there in Rapid City. And, hopefully he forgives me, because I'll get a little bit into his past. But he's told everyone about it. So he's kind of good with it now. So he was addicted to heroin from his teenage years. Kind of couldn't get his life together whatsoever, go in and out of rehab. Even during rehab, he would still use. Because that's where I got a lot of information from is, we get free time where no one's with us, so we just go out and buy drugs, get high, come back, so it was like a never-ending cycle. So he came out here a little hesitant, not like super open up to the idea of like trusting other people to help you with your life. I was mm-hmm. like I think the mindset was from my understanding, the mindset was I've tried this before, I don't know if that's going to work. I wouldn't say rocky, he actually had a decent start, waking up, starting to buy into the program. And that's again with anything, is like your level of commitment, it really does pay off. So started committing right off the bat, and then before we knew it, 1 month sober, we'd celebrate, 2 months sober, we'd celebrate, all the way up through eight months sober. And this is honestly, as he said, this is the longest stint that he has been sober off of anything.
Wow.
Just watching him, like a before and after picture, like skin and bones he started our weightlifting program for the guys. Pretty well built now, super healthy. And you can just tell from the two pictures of the transition. Like I said, it's completely optional if they want to buy it or not. Got saved, got baptized, and is pretty on fire, to where he got hired on as summer staff at Kidder Creek, which is one of the Christian camps up the road.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, it's one of the maintenance guys. So
are you guys, I mean, with someone like that comes into that facility and you take away their access to drugs in this case. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you guys able to deal, or how are you dealing with coming off of those substances?
So ideally we request, keyword request, that they at least detox for 30 days.
Before
they come.
Got it.
Does that always happen? Unfortunately not. So we, like I said, we meet them where we're at. We try to help as best as possible. If it gets really bad, like we've had instances in the past where we took guys to the doctor, they got prescribed Suboxone to kind of help wean off of heroin, and that does seem to help too. So, and I mean, it's not like it's not like an end of the world event if they're struggling, because I mean just by kind of meeting them where they're at, just having like, hey man, we're here to help. I know you don't believe that in your first 2-3 weeks, but
right,
what do you need from us? How can we best help you? How can we best serve you? How can we best get you to where you want to be in life?
Right.
And just over time, it does go a long way. It does. You kind of see that start building in their lives to where, it becomes a huge community. It becomes like another part of your family. And it's kind of cool watching these guys start from day one to when they graduate. And it's like, wow, man. Like I remember our first coaching session. Yeah. It was like super awkward.
You describe in your own story, Chris, this this sort of life of trial and overcoming and trust and faith in many ways. And I can certainly see how you're applying that today in the other cadre or instructor staff at the program. I mean, is this prerequisite for trial within the instructor staff almost required or necessitated? I mean, how do you guys view that when you think about bringing folks on to help?
Not necessarily, as far as the trial piece. Craig, our director, will probably correct me when I'm wrong if I'm wrong on this one. So this all started from an idea, and it's a lot of kind of like learn as you go. A lot of like what we we've done, a lot of like what we've tried, and even now, I mean, since I started working here to today, is like we've revamped a lot of our policies, just because with humans, I mean, that's the outlier.
That's such a great point, though. It's so true, though. you can't account for human behavior in many instances.
Yeah. So that of course is the outlier, and I really think that it's more or less the understanding the biblically based aspects of the program. Like if there's a confrontation between two students, it's hey, we're gonna have a mediation. And like, if you guys still can't agree, I'm going to bring in another staff member, and you guys still can't agree, I'm going to bring in a third staff member. And, that's coming out of the New Testament. I mean, yeah, just kind of bring people in and just kind of talk through it, and let's find a better approach. And kind of go from there. I love the use of the line. I'm like, yeah. Jesus said you got to love people, man. You don't have to like them sometimes, but you got to love them. So,
why the focus on men only at this particular program?
So, yeah, it's kind of just like we saw a need for it. That there wasn't a lot. Ideally, at the time there was a woman's version of Rockside in the Valley too. Unfortunately they ran into some financial troubles and had to kind of close up. Ideally that's in the future. We are striving for a women's version. And it really boils down to one majority of the staff are males, and it's the whole spiritual mentorship piece. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I've used the example because I know guys come in every now and then. It's like, yeah, I want one of the female staff members to be my coach. It's like, look, man, I could probably be a woman's pastor and do a decent job, but I can't meet her on a lot of her emotional needs because I don't understand. I've been married for 20 plus years, and there's times I don't understand my wife. So and it really boils down to, it's like, yeah, men help men, women help women, and that's where we come together, and then we can start helping each other out simultaneously.
RocksideRanch.org. Are there other social media outlets that folks can find out about you or what you guys are doing?
Yeah. So we're on Facebook. We're on Instagram.
What's the Instagram?
I believe it's Rockside Ranch.
Okay.
I don't have Instagram. Sorry.
I don't either. I can't help you there.
But yeah, Rockside Ranch, Facebook, Instagram. A lot of our videos are on, Vimeo, I think it is.
Yeah.
Vimeo okay. and YouTube.
Yeah.
So yeah, so if you want to take a look at it, all our contact information is on the website. Most of the video links are on the website.
This was a special episode for me. As a Christian, a military veteran who found purpose in agriculture, and as the brother to a young man who struggled with addiction for many years, I felt connected to much of Chris's story and the mission at Rockside. Military veterans struggling with post-traumatic stress or other issues are not the only group who can benefit from the purpose and principles a life in agriculture imparts. 8 months is a long time to be sequestered on a working ranch with limited communications, often alone with your thoughts and your past decisions as you labor away. But to me, this speaks to the resilience of Rockside Ranch, its program, and to men like Chris. Because these types of habits which led these men to Rockside aren't reshaped in a day. It takes time to break them and create new ones. And the physical and mental grit built through shared hardships in an environment like agriculture will last a lifetime. If you'd like to learn more about Rockside Ranch or feel compelled to donate to their cause, check out their website at rocksideranch.org. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSau, and until next time, stay frosty.